the private liability of the stablecoin is not going to operate or function as money at scale without central bank backing.
Where does money come from, and how do we ensure there's the right amount of it? Today, we're wondering what happens when new forms of digital money change the answers to those questions. So today on Vox Talks Economics, the future of the money supply. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Center for Economic Policy Research. I'm Tim Phillips. CEPR's Barcelona reports focus on the future of banking. The eighth report is just out, just published by CEPR, and it focuses on the regulation of all forms of digital money. The question of who creates the money that we use has become more complicated than ever. And could innovation throw the system on which we rely out of whack, especially in a crisis? Steve Cecchetti of Brandeis University, an old friend of Vox Talks Economics, also the CPR, is one of the authors. He joins me now. Steve, welcome back to Vox Talks Economics.
Oh, thanks, Tim. It's really nice to be here and nice to speak with you.
Steve, first of all, for anyone who's still catching up with this, where does money come from? Who creates it?
It's a great question because it's something that most of us just take for granted. We don't actually really think much about it. There really are two sorts of money out there, which I think we could label public money and private money. Central banks, government institutions, supply public money, and that comes in the form of currency and bank reserves. Individuals, normal people, don't have any real relationship with bank reserves, although they do play an important role, but we're all pretty used to currency. We're pretty used to banknotes. At least we used to be. I just got back from a trip, and I was this time in Switzerland and Germany, and you didn't need to have banknotes. And I know in London, you don't need to have banknotes. The point is that when you don't use banknotes, what you're using is something that's created by commercial banks. You're using privately supplied money. And so what's happening is that a bank is making a loan. It's crediting a deposit account of the borrower. The borrower has this deposit, which is private money, and it functions as money because it can be at some point through agreement converted into central bank money on demand and at par. So it's essential that the central bank and the government overall stands behind what the banks are doing, but we're not using money, as it were, that's created by the government. We're using money that's created by the banks. And the numbers here, I think, are quite striking. That is that of the money that we have, things that we would call money, things that we can use to pay for things, if you were to purchase a car or a refrigerator, there's probably about 10% of it at most is actual banknotes. And those are really not used that much anymore in any case. Mm-hmm. So most of the money we spend is supplied by private banks, not by central banks. Most of it's private money, not public money. But the fact that the central bank stands behind it is what's important for us, because as we'll talk about, that's what means that we are willing to accept it.
Why don't commercial banks just carry on making money forever? It'd be in their interest.
Not really. And I think that there are a couple of reasons for that. One of them is that it's not actually in the interest of the bank, because when the bank makes a loan, it credits a deposit, as I suggested a moment ago, but the borrower is going to go spend that deposit. You don't borrow from the bank. You don't take out a loan to just leave it sitting there. So the bank has to be concerned about it, the fact that the money that it is creating could leave, and that the recipient of the payments may have a different bank. So the lending that the bank is doing, then that lending can't exceed the resources that the bank currently has. And so there's a limit to how much of this it can actually do, because at some point it could effectively run out. That's one reason. But there's another reason, too, which is that there's regulation that caps the amount of this activity that the bank can even start to think about. So there are capital and liquidity requirements that the bank has to meet as well. So I would say that the two reasons are risk management and prudence on the part of the bank to begin with, and regulation.
So if the system's a little bit more complicated than most people who don't think about where money comes from, which is almost everybody apart from economists, would imagine, how long has this system been in place?
It depends on what system you're talking about. There is a form of the system that's been around since the mid-17th century. So the idea here is that there were goldsmiths. Goldsmiths had vaults, and so they would take deposits of other people's gold and store them in their vaults, and they would give the owner of the gold a little slip of paper, and that little slip of paper could then start trading around. And it didn't take long for the goldsmiths to become bankers and realize that they could issue more pieces of paper than they had gold in their vaults. And so they became what an economist calls a fractional reserve bank. This is a dangerous activity because if everyone comes for their gold at the same time, you've got too many of these little slips of paper out there and they can't get it all back. But the point is that this is about as old as, let's say, Newtonian physics, what I just described. Now, there are a lot of other versions of it. Then everything else you sort of look, you say, well, technology is taking over. Well, technology is about how I store information, how I transmit information, and how easy it is for us to make transactions. I could make a payment to you right now. You're sitting in London and I'm sitting in Boston. That would have been rather difficult in the 17th century. I would have had to actually physically figure out how to meet you. I don't have to do that anymore. But the transaction's the same. So in that sense, there's very little difference, and it's quite an old process.
Given it's been going on for so long, is it automatic that this whole thing stays in balance?
In the early days, the important thing was that what we really trusted as money was specie. It was pieces of metal. Those pieces of metal might have had their own problems associated with them. For example, kings like to change the metal content of the coins in order to try and gain revenue. But in the modern world, what we have is just pure fiat currency that's backed by governments. And so the real question, I think, and the fundamental one that we have to wrestle with is why private money is trusted. And the simple answer is that we have a set of institutions that ensure what I would call general acceptance. So we all accept a deposit at face value without doing any balance sheet analysis on the bank that issued it. My guess is that if you purchased a cup of coffee on your way in this morning in London, you did it by transferring a portion of your bank deposit to the barista who hopefully made you a good cup of coffee. But my guess is also that you and the barista knew nothing at all about who was banking where. They didn't care what your bank was. You didn't care what their bank was. All that mattered was you got your coffee and they got their payment. What is the institutional setup that makes it so that we don't care and that we can trust that this is going on? I think that that's really the big issue. And there are three things then, and we discuss this in the report, and it's also discussed quite a lot by my former colleagues at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel. Our three things we call one of the monetary uniformity. Uniformity means that a dollar is a dollar, a euro is a euro, a pound's a pound, regardless of what deposit it is at what bank. Bank deposits are trading at par. That's what made it so that your barista didn't care what your bank was, that the money you were paying was the same as the money that they had in their bank. The second thing is that claims can move, and that's what you did, was you moved it between yourself and the barista. It moves between users and it moves across institutions, and it does this at very low cost at any time. And it ends in what's called final settlement, which is to say that once the payment is made, there's no obligation on the part of the recipient to reverse it. And there's no ability, unless there's fraud or something like that, for you to get it back. So you all agree that there's this system where the payment is final and there's no residual risk associated with it. The third thing that's important is much more subtle, but turns out to be an important institutional factor in ensuring general acceptance. And that's the fact that the quantity of this stuff can expand and contract with demand. So banks are willing to supply more in good times by extending credit. But the critical thing is that the system has to be able to expand when it's under stress. So when demand for safe assets, if you will, spikes, so when demand for bank deposits or even bank notes spikes, there has to be a mechanism for it to expand. So those three things are, I think, really important, and they shouldn't be taken for granted. And the critical ingredient that makes this possible is really the existence of the central bank and what the central bank does. Because before we understood central banking as we do today, that, I think, is really a phenomenon of the late 19th and early 20th century. I think that there were problems. People would create banks. the banks would issue notes. The notes would not necessarily trade at par with the notes from other banks. And so the fact is you didn't have this monetary uniformity or singleness, and that was really a serious problem. But today our institutions very clearly support that.
Oh, and by the way, Steve, the coffee around here, it's excellent.
I know.
How new forms of money are created and regulated is something we're talking about a lot on Vox Talks in 2026. So if this is your thing, check out on our recent episodes. And you'll also enjoy our episode featuring Steve and his co-author Kim Schoenholtz from 2023, when we discuss the lessons from the failures of Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and First Republic. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to listen to the episode Making Banking Safe from December that year.
What forms of digital money are you considering in the report?
Let me just start out by saying, and this is one of my fundamental points whenever I think about this, and I try to remind myself and others, that all of finance is a database code and a set of agreed upon protocols for who can make changes to what. So it's all digital. It's all been digital for a pretty long time, probably 50 years, 60 years, I'm not sure, something like that, certainly half a century at least. And as I suggested earlier, 90% of what we think of as money is digital, and it all is on an electronic ledger somewhere. What's new is not the fact that there's a database in code, but it's the structure of the database, the nature of the code, and the way in which the protocols are written and how the changes can be made. But those are like technical things. Things haven't changed much. In the report, we look at central bank digital currency, tokenized deposits, and stablecoins. Central bank digital currency, we focus on retail, which is where individuals, households, and firms can hold direct claims on the central bank, not against a commercial bank. And in legal terms, the idea is that this will be, and that doesn't only exist in a few places, is going to be the same as paper bank notes, but now they're going to be in a digital wallet on your smartphone, and you can transfer them to someone else's. Tokenized deposits are basically bank deposits with the same, all of the same things surrounding them, the same structures, legal claims, supervision, deposit insurance, access to the central bank that their issuing bank has, all of those things just inside of the bank perimeter, but they're tokenized in the sense that they're programmable. The third one is stablecoins. These are privately issued tokens that promise one-for-one redemption into a sovereign currency. The dollar version is the biggest, and the issuer takes your dollar, puts it in a reserve fund, short-term treasuries or bank deposits or something, and you get a token. So the balance sheet looks like the balance sheet really of a money market fund, if you will, where there are assets that are liquid securities, bank deposits, and the like, and liabilities, which are the tokens which you have.
The tokenized deposits, it sounds like they don't change very much.
The tokenized deposits are not a fundamental change and not even one that most of us would notice.
No.
What we would notice probably is that they would gain a certain types of characteristics that we might or might not find useful. We might be able to use them more easily across borders. We might be able to use them more easily on the weekends. We might also be able to set that they're programmed in certain ways. So imagine a case where you purchase a train ticket. This is particularly useful in the UK. If the train runs on the time, the train company gets the full payment. If you're 10 minutes late, they get 90%. If it's 30 minutes late, and this is all programmed into the money. People might find that useful. I think there are some pretty big downsides to some of that, but that's another issue. And so these are just basically a version of online payments that could be made conditional and programmable.
The retail central bank digital currency,
mm-hmm.
Is that private money or public money?
It's public money for sure, because it exists on the central bank's balance sheet.
Uh-huh.
So in that sense, it's the same as paper bank notes that are issued by the central bank.
So if we get central bank digital currency, does that crowd out private money? And does that matter if it does?
It could. It could. It depends on what the central bank decides to do with the proceeds. So imagine you take the funds out of your commercial bank, you convert them into central bank digital currency. That's a liability to the central bank. What does the central bank do on its asset side? Does it recycle that immediately into the banking system? Does it loan it back to the bank that you took it out of, in which case that becomes a liability of the bank? Does the loan from the central bank look just like your deposit looked? You know, you just gave your deposit to the bank and you didn't pay any attention. Is the central bank just going to give the money? Or will the central bank now demand certain kinds of collateral? We discuss this at some length in our report, and there's a what I would call a neutrality result, which is that if all of the central bank digital currency, the proceeds, are lent back to the banks on exactly the same terms as the depositors were essentially lending, if you will, to the banks, then there's no change and it doesn't crowd anything out. But central banks don't normally behave that way, at least not in the current world. It could change, of course, but they don't. They require collateral and their haircuts, and they'll only take certain kinds of collateral. And in that case, then the way in which they treat the collateral and those decisions could have a big impact, or at least some impact, on the lending activities of the banks. And in the limit, it starts to look like a state bank. So you have to be a bit careful with this.
Stablecoins, is this creating money in the same way as commercial banks create money?
Stablecoins are not creating money, because what happens is that you take the funds out of your bank, you give them to Circle or Tether, the biggest of the stablecoin issuers. They're going to take those proceeds and purchase securities with them, or they'll deposit them back in the bank. And if they're purchasing securities, they could very well just be purchasing the same securities that your bank was selling as it tried to meet your deposit withdrawal request. So in the aggregate, the answer is it changes nothing. It's not money creation. And remember, the money creation story is about banks making loans, and stablecoin providers don't make loans.
So this report's all about the regulatory environment. When we're talking about these new forms of money, particularly stablecoins, is the regulation more or less equivalent around the world?
The short answer is that it's early days. But it appears, at least at the moment, that the answer is no. We discussed three different jurisdictions, and those have different philosophies. There's the US case with the Genius Act. There's the European Union with the Markets and Crypto Assets Act, which went into force in 2024, what's called MiCA. And then there's a proposal from the Bank of England. And the question, I think, is whether the private liabilities, the stablecoins, are going to function as money at scale or not, whether they can do it without central bank backing. I argued earlier that the central bank's critical for backing stablecoins. In the case of the US, the answer is that there's a principle-based regulation. It's supposed to go into effect in about 2027, but only if the stablecoins are issued by bank-affiliated issuers will they have access to the central bank. And that means that only those will operate as money. In the European Union, the philosophy is one of sort of restrictive containment, if you will, where issuers actually have to hold 30 to 60% of their reserves in bank deposits. So they're trying to keep the deposits in the banks. And that, I think, is going to create a different kind of problem. But there, they expressly have no central bank backing. The UK and the Bank of England is very different, where they're explicitly looking to have at least large stablecoin issuers become what I would call a narrow bank with significant reserve deposits at the Bank of England in order to ensure that the things do end up operating much more like money. Same instrument design, three different philosophies. All of them agree, I think, on the fact that the private liability of the stablecoin is not going to operate or function as money at scale without central bank backing.
Now, of course, the value of regulation is when things go wrong, or things might go wrong, to ensure that it doesn't. If we're not in normal times, generally speaking, in recent years, how has the money supply adjusted when confidence falters?
Well, the central bank steps in and starts providing it. The idea is to keep the quantity of money in the system from collapsing. when that happens, we tend to get very bad economic outcomes. It can create deflation in the worst case, recessions follow otherwise. So the central bank does seem to be essential. And so the key institutional feature that allows this to happen is the idea of the lender of last resort. This is a 19th century idea. It's Walter Bagehot, who at the time, I think, was already the editor of The Economist magazine. And his prescription from 1873 still holds pretty well. Lend freely against good collateral at a penalty rate, as he said. Now, there have been a lot of discussion about this over the last 150 years. But the point is that you need a central bank and that there is no private solution. Mm-hmm. And we've seen the central bank then step in a lot of cases, most recently, you know, with Silicon Valley Bank, where there was huge lending made to the deposit insurer, which was the Resolution Authority, as it took over Silicon Valley Bank. But even more importantly, you might ask yourself, you know, here's a really bad circumstance. The Silicon Valley Bank failed on the 10th of March, was a Friday in 2003. How is it that Silicon Valley Bank, which was pretty much known to be insolvent, why is it that their liabilities were still trading at par on Thursday as they were facing a run? Mm-hmm. So why is it that you could withdraw your funds from Silicon Valley Bank, and if you had even $1 million or $10 million, a lot, you could withdraw them at par, and that transaction would settle if you ran to, you know, one of the large banks? And the answer is that the Federal Reserve stood behind that during that day, even though they should have been probably shut down months before, but that's a different issue.
So stablecoins, do they have a lender of last resort?
Well, the problem here, of course, is no. In the EU, MiCA is explicit about the fact that they don't. In the US, as I suggested earlier, only if you're a bank-affiliated issuer. And in the UK, they would have one for if they're what qualifies as a systemic issuer. But I think the real issue for me is not whether there's a stated commitment of central bank backing, but whether or not the claim that you're not going to have it can be credible. And here, I think the right comparison is to money market accounts. And we've seen in the last 20 years, two times when money market accounts have basically been backstopped by the Federal Reserve as they started to fail and to suffer from runs. And in fact, Circle, the issuer of USDC, the second largest stablecoin that's out there, held $3.3 billion of its reserves at SVB and was basically bailed out by the Federal Reserve. So I do not believe that it's credible to claim that you're not going to support these under stress. Hmm. You're not going to just let them fail.
Have the major stablecoin issuers become too big to fail now?
Well, first of all, Tether's not a U.S. company, and the amounts now are starting to look like they could become systemic. I don't believe they are yet, but SVB didn't look systemic at first until everybody said, oh, if SVB goes under, all the medium-sized banks are going to go with it, so we better support them. The question in my mind is, if you let the stablecoin issuers go broke, what happens to the rest of the crypto ecosystem? Because stablecoins are the medium of exchange in the crypto ecosystem. So they serve the same purpose as a money market fund does for your brokerage account, where that's where, you know, when you buy and sell things, it goes through that account. Stablecoins are serving that. I think that it's going to be hard not to support them.
For central bank digital currencies, in a situation like this, does the bank just issue more CBDCs?
Under stress, you're asking whether they would. I think the answer is that they would have to. And I think that that's a problem. And one of the ways in which the issuers, I mean, the one I followed the most, which is the biggest and the furthest along among the large countries, is the digital euro. And there, the claim is that they're going to set a limit on how much is being held, 3,000 euros, maybe some sort of number like that for an individual. The question is whether they can hold to that under times of stress. And I'm not so sure. I think it will become there will be significant political pressure to issue more, and then political pressure on the central bank to favor certain sectors in the real economy as that happens.
Final question, Steve. If we have all these regulatory challenges that have come along because of these new technologies, can they be resolved by competition between the forms of money, by local regulation in countries, Or do we need a stronger consensus? And who provides that consensus?
It's a very good way to put the question, because I think it gets to the point that, first of all, competition, I don't think, isn't going to work here. It's not going to do it. Money, like liabilities, generate a lot of externalities. They have a lot of positive externalities that come from everybody using them, but they also have negative ones in the form of runs, contagion, panics, fire sales. Competition can drive efficiency in normal times, but it's going to accelerate failure, I think, under stress. Local regulation is going to be necessary but not sufficient because the instruments are global. Remember, Tether is issued in El Salvador, a place which they recently moved because they didn't like the British Virgin Islands,
right,
if you can imagine that. They moved out of a Caribbean jurisdiction which was quite lax because they didn't like it. But stablecoins issued in El Salvador, held by users in Argentina, traded on a Singaporean exchange, backed by U.S. Treasury securities, is not going to be supervised effectively by any one jurisdiction acting alone. You're going to need international standards. You're going to need international cooperation and coordination. And I hope we can get it.
I think we all hope we can get it. Steve, thank you very much for talking about this today.
Thank you very much, Tim. Always nice to talk to you.
The CPR Barcelona Report number 8 is called Digital Money in the Future of Banking series. The authors Dirk Niepeltz, Steve Cicchetti, Ellen Ray, and Javier Vives. It is available as a free download from CEPR.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next week on Vox Talks Economics, how did the sewing machine affect the lives of women in the 19th century?